Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks very much for coming to this talk, as you can see from the title, about programming with constraints. There we go. I picked this topic for a very simple reason. I believe that thinking about constraints is going to become a routine part of our daily tasks. And this is because it looks like we have a new keyword, namely requires, coming down the pipeline for C++ 20. Some of you may be familiar with it from the concepts light technical specification. And I'll tell you all about that. We've made some progress with respect to that. And the purpose of a requires keyword will be to introduce what are called requires clauses and requires expressions. So we'll talk about that. But it turns out that although the syntax obviously is going to be new to C++, the ideas are not at all new. And accordingly, in this talk, I want to explore what these ideas mean for us at a technical level, and how they have affected our code of the past and how they will continue to affect our code today and in the future. Some of this material is adapted from a paper I wrote for WG21, the Standards Committee, earlier this year. You're welcome to go look it up if you like. And with that, let's start by looking at what I like to call the bigger picture. So let's start by looking at six terms of art, if you will. A left column and a right column. Take a moment, if you'd be so kind. Now, this is not a quiz. Don't raise your hand. Don't shout out any answers. But take a moment and see if you can look at those and see what they have in common. The second column is headed with constraints. The first column is headed with preconditions. It's not an accident. So from my perspective, what all of these things have in common is the notion of expressing requirements. Requirements that some component, often a function, but not necessarily just functions, a requirement that is imposed by a component and that the component is entitled to expect or assume, if you prefer, always holds true. And therefore, we as programmers can write those components accordingly. It's not something we test for, it's something we assume to be true. So here's an interesting question. How do these terms of art differ? Why don't we just have the word requirement? Why do we have all of this vocabulary? So it turns out there are some differences among them, and the differences turn out to be the way the component responds when the requirement fails to hold, when it is not satisfied. Some of these requirements affect the correct use of the component, but others affect the component's existence. Of course, if it doesn't exist, you can't use it, right? So let's talk briefly about preconditions first, right? As most of us, I think, know, a function's precondition is typically a predicate that the function assumes to be true. When? At the point that the function is called. Okay? That typically means it holds at runtime, but nowadays we live in a const expert world, so that can move up to compile time sometimes. But the point is that that precondition has to hold when the function is called. No sooner, and later we don't really care. Okay? And it has to hold each time. Doesn't have to hold in between, but at the point the function is called, the precondition has to hold. Now, for example, I think many programmers believe that, let's say from the standard library, the square root function in CMath. I think a lot of programmers would believe that there's a precondition that the value you supply must be not be negative. That's not true. The function has perfectly well-defined behavior if you happen to give it a negative number. It gives you an error no, for example. That's well-defined behavior. So that is not a precondition. All right? A function, you know, a lot of programmers write their functions and they test for the validity of the precondition. If you do that, you don't have a precondition. Pre, as in before you make the call. It's not the function's responsibility, it's the caller's responsibility. Okay? The standard, the C++ standard, and this is not new, this has been there all along, and there's the citation if you choose to look it up. If you call a function when the precondition fails to hold, you get undefined behavior. It might do what you expect, but you're not entitled to count on that. It is undefined behavior to call a function out of contract, we say. So you're probably aware that precondition is part of what we call a function's contract with its clients. We have some relatively recent new nomenclature. I'm not sure why we needed this. But if you have a function that has no preconditions, we say that it has a wide contract, wide as in wide open. If there are any preconditions, one or more, then we say the function has a narrow contract. From my perspective, I can tell the difference between zero and anything bigger than zero, but that's the nomenclature we use these days. But this is really only tangential to our main topic of the day, which is constraints. So I'm not going to talk very much more about preconditions, except to have noted the distinction. But here's a little breadcrumb for the future. Keep your eye out for a new attribute sometime in the future. Maybe C++ 20, maybe C++ 23, not sure. Still in progress. It will be labeled expects. Okay? Now, how do constraints differ from preconditions? Well, a constraint is always a compile time predicate. Always, always, always. It's associated with some program component. Could be a function, could be a template, for example. Could be any kind of template. Could be a variable template, could be a class template, doesn't matter. You can have a constraint on it. And the constraint must be satisfied. There's no what if. It must be satisfied. Or else. Now, I suspect you're all thinking the same thing that I am, or else what? Right? Or else the component won't and mustn't be compiled. Effectively, it will not exist if the constraint is unsatisfied. Will not exist. So if it's a function, you mustn't call it. It doesn't exist. You can't take its address. It doesn't exist. You can't use it. But the fact that it won't be compiled is not necessarily, in and of itself, an error. You might get a consequential error. You try to use it and it doesn't exist. That's an error. That's not the fault of the component. That's your code that's trying to use a non-existent component. Okay? But we all have some experience with this. In this particular regard, it is not unlike conditional preprocessing. Just because something is not compiled does not necessarily, in and of itself, mean that there's anything wrong. This may be a desired outcome. Depends on what the predicate is, right? But when you're talking about a constraint, and if you take away nothing else, remember this. If the constraint is not satisfied, the component will not be compiled. Some cases may give you a diagnostic. It depends on how it's coded, but not necessarily, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. That may be a desired result. Okay? You may have an overload situation, for example. You have multiple constraints. One of them is satisfied, the others aren't. You can only call the one that exists. All right? Now, I'd like to point out that this is not at all new. I know I said this before, but here are some examples. C++ is all about constraints from day one. I mean, you can say this about any language that features strong type checking. And of course, C++ is famous for strong type checking, right? Well, when you assign a type to a variable, when you make that binding, you are imposing a constraint on that variable, a constraint on how you can use it. You can't assign a string to an int. That's a constraint violation. That won't compile, will it? That'll give you a diagnostic. Okay? So we are all familiar with constraints, but perhaps have not thought of it in quite these terms before. And I'll give you some more examples shortly. Okay? The era that we refer to as C++ 98, C++ 03, limited us to sort of these implicit techniques. But we have had newer technologies now for almost a decade. Because C++ 11, and even before that, if you count TR1, for example, we have had some new tools for, let's say, explicit programming with constraints. For example, we got static assert in C++ 11. Okay? You put that inside a component, that component will not compile unless that predicate is true. And you'll get a diagnostic of your choice. Unless you're programming in C++ 17, where the literal became optional. I had a little something to do with that. We got in C++ 11 in the standard library, we got enable if, typically used in a Svine context, and we'll talk a little more about that shortly, to prevent the template's instantiation. And of course, if it's not instantiated, it can't be compiled. The constraint fails, it won't be compiled. Okay? We got expression Svine, which is not as well known, but it's an expansion of the contexts in which you can apply such techniques. Before then, we had a limited number of contexts. Now we have a lot more ever since C++ 11. And even more recently, we got more good stuff in this particular area. C++ 17 has void t in the standard library. I had a lot to do with that. I will not speak about that further today, but if you're interested, please go look at the video of my talk here at CPPCon from 2014. That's when I first sprung void t on the world. The last half hour approximately, it's a 2-hour talk. And by the way, thank you to the 40,000 people who've watched that. That's an unbelievable number considering, you know, my name isn't Bjarne or Herb, you know. But thank you all. We also got in C++ 17 the constexpr if, spelled if constexpr. But the feature is called constexpr if, and with it you get discarded statements. The predicate doesn't hold. That part doesn't get compiled, okay? And we've been working on C++ 20 already. C++ 17 by now is old hat for the standards committee. We've been working on C++ 20 now for 6 months or so. And we have recently added to the working draft, and that's freely publicly available if you choose to download it. If you're not used to reading legalese, you probably don't want to read the actual standard. It's a 1,400-page legal document is what it boils down to. We were very careful with the wording because in some jurisdictions, it actually has the force of law. It gets incorporated by reference into contracts and things like that. So putting out a C++ standard is like negotiating an international treaty in many respects. It's a little surprising. But we've added the concepts requires keyword. And of course, I'll talk much more about that later on. So let me start by talking a little more about what I'm going to call pre-modern constraints. So suppose, yes, notice it's down near the bottom. This is how we used to have to write the code. And by the way, this slide gave me more trouble in PowerPoint than any other. PowerPoint really wants to show things from top down, okay? So we need a C++ programmer to fix that, but okay. So let me use this example. This is going to be a running example. We'll revisit this 2 or 3 times, okay? Suppose what I want to do is just to, you know, give me a value and I'll raise it to a given power where the power is known at compile time. So, you know, a little simple bit of metaprogramming, but, you know, no big deal. And the algorithm that I want to use is one that'll give me logarithmic behavior in terms of number of multiplications. The naive approach, I mean, what you teach kids to start with when they first learn exponents is, you know, you multiply it so many times. You raise to the nth power, you multiply, you have n minus 1 multiplications. Okay, well, we can do better. If you want to say x to the 8th, you square x, you square that, you square that, you're done, 3 multiplications. That's logarithmic behavior. So suppose I want that algorithm. It turns out the easiest way to code that is with some specializations, a primary template and a couple of specializations, okay? But I want to make this a function, and you can't partially specialize functions in C++. So what technique did we have to use? We have to dispatch to something else that you can partially specialize, right? So, you know, you got to declare that up above, right? So it's my helper that'll implement that log n behavior. So I'll have a primary template with 2 partial specializations. There's the primary. And it turns out it will only operate on values of n that are odd. Now, that's not obvious by inspection, but it'll turn out that the specializations will handle all the evens. So the only thing left for the primary will be the odds. But please notice the stuff in yellow. In particular, notice the third template parameter, a bool, not named. I never have to refer to it, so it doesn't need a name. And the predicate is the answer to the question, is n an even number? Okay? So now the specializations, right? If that's true, so here's where evens get handled. If that's true, we do the naive, you know, square the thing and then reduce n by half. Except you need another case to handle the case of 0, which is even, but I don't want any multiplications. So that's kind of how you would do this thing. And there, you know, you can play some tricks and do a little bit better job, but this is kind of straightforward to look at. This is how what we would do in C++ 98. But we can do better. And I'll return to this example twice more. But those are constraints. When you specialize a template, you're putting a constraint on that specialization. If the constraint isn't met, that specialization won't be compiled. Okay? Now, in C++ 11, I mentioned we got enable if, among other things. If you're not familiar with it, let me give you a real fast overview. It's a meta function. You hand it a predicate, you hand it a type. The predicate is true, you get back an alias to the type. If the predicate is false, there is no alias. This is a feature you can only do in metaprogramming. You can't write a function that refuses to give you an answer. I mean, yes, you can throw exceptions, you can call std terminate, things like that. But if you have a normal return, you can't have a function that gives you no answer. But in metaprogramming, you can. And what does it look like? Well, it's a primary template and one specialization. I've chosen to have the primary handle the case where it's true, and you'll notice there's the alias using type equals t. And then the specialization, when the predicate is false, a constraint, there is no alias. Empty braces, right? So this is what enable it, this is how it's almost always implemented. I mean, you can flip the role of the primary and the specialization, but there's almost no other way to implement this. And you can say, okay, that's pretty straightforward, but what good is that? So what? Well, first, think about one thing. Think about a call to that meta function where the predicate is false, but you're asking for the type anyway, as if there were an alias. And most programmers who have not seen this before would say, well, that's got to be an error. Well, it is sometimes an error, and welcome to Svine. Now, what has that got to do with constraint programming? Well, we have to talk about Svine a little bit first. And I know I've spoken about this before, and some of you are familiar with Svinay, but there's a new wrinkle in C++ 17 that you may not yet have encountered. So let me go through it at a sort of high level, okay? So there are two main steps in instantiating any template declaration. I mean, yes, there are lots more details I don't propose to go into, but there are two principal steps. And the first one has got to be, what are my arguments? What are the template arguments? Okay? So how does the compiler determine either, well, you can see it's up there. Sometimes deduce, sometimes just get your hands on. How do you obtain the template argument? And it turns out there are now four ways this can happen. There used to be three, we now have four. New in C++ 17, okay? And they can arise in combination if you have multiple template arguments. One can come about this way, one can come about a different way, okay? So what are the four? Well, I've labeled them A, B, C, D. Obviously, if the client supplies the argument, we take it verbatim, we're done, okay? Otherwise, if it's a function template, the compiler can go and, you know, look at the actual arguments in the call and say, okay, what are the types of those arguments, and deduce and get the template argument that way. C, which is new for 17, if you have a class template, we now have a feature called deduction guides. Previously, if you wanted to declare a std vector, you always had to say std vector of some type, std vector of int, std vector of double, std vector of my type. You don't necessarily have to say that anymore. The compiler can figure it out under certain circumstances if you provide appropriate initializers. Okay? Now, this is off topic, so treat this as a breadcrumb, something you might want to look into for the future, but this is new. And the final fallback, if none of the above work, maybe there are some defaults in the declaration of the template. Okay, so we now have four possibilities for the compiler to consider. And this is all still the first step of instantiating a template declaration. So what's the second step? Well, now that you know what the arguments are, it's time to use them. And this is what's referred to as the substitution step. Every placeholder, which are the template parameters, has to be replaced by the corresponding argument. Okay? All right, so there are two possible outcomes. All right? I mean, simply put, it can go well or it can go ill. All right? So if all goes well, you end up with a well-formed declaration and you just proceed normally. I mean, maybe the next step is overload resolution. I mean, whatever comes next in your compiler, just keep going. No big deal. But what if it doesn't work out? If the resulting declaration is not well-formed, and of course we call that ill-formed, it is considered not viable. And that's a term of art in the standard. It's not viable. Why not? Well, in this case, it's because of substitution failure. Things didn't work out. And what happens? It's not an error. That component, that declaration, is silently discarded. There is no diagnostic. In other words, substitution failure is not an error. Svinay. The term was coined in the early 2000s by David van der Voort, I believe. Okay? So that, in a nutshell, that's how Svinay works. And there are some other speakers this week who will talk more about Svinay, I'm told. So, you know, what the question is, what is this good for? You know, how does this affect programming with constraints? Well, the most common use of Svinay is via enable if. So I'm about to show you a set of three functions constituting an overload set. And if you look at the predicates, at the constraints, you will find that at most one of them can be true and the other two will not hold, will be unsatisfied. which means those two will be silently discarded and I'm left with exactly one. So let's return to my example. Okay? Three overloads to do those, you know, those three parts of my algorithm. All right? If n is 0, return 1. But notice, enable if requires here that n be exactly 0. Well, okay, well, what if it isn't? Well, then there is no return type for this function. Enable if has nothing to return. And the declaration becomes ill-formed and is silently discarded. Alternatively, here's an overload. Notice, same function, you know, same function signature. It's an overload, same name, but with a different predicate. This time, if n is non-zero and even, do it this way. If that doesn't hold, that's also going to be ill-formed for exactly the same reason, and it won't be compiled. Silently. Not a bad thing, because I'm going to want the case when it's odd. So I've written my constraints so that they're mutually exclusive. At most, one will be well-formed. The other two are silently discarded. Okay, and this is a typical use for enable if in the standard library. And of course, as I said, we've had this since C++ 11. We've actually had it since TR1, but not everybody used TR1. Okay? So programming with constraints is really not new. So why aren't we happy with enable if? I mean, what's wrong with it? Well, nothing really. But, I mean, let's be honest, there are some limitations to this idiom. I mean, for openers, it requires a template. You can't apply it to non-templates. If you want to apply it to a function that's a constructor, it's a little more challenging because there's no return type. So where do you put the enable if? You can make it an extra argument maybe, but that's visible to the user. You can make it an extra template parameter, but that's visible to the user. You get the idea. It's a little more challenging. Okay? There's some design issues all of a sudden. Okay? And let's be honest, further, what you get is not exactly transparent. Okay? If this were the first time that you encounter enable if, you might say, you know, what the dickens is this? What's going on here? Because you really have to understand the idiom to be able to read code like that. Once you do, it's fine. But it's like anything else. You have to become familiar with it. People like to use the word weird. It just means unfamiliar. All right? It's weird. That's because you don't get it yet. Once you understand it, it's no longer weird, right? It's familiar. And it turns out we have newer techniques, which brings us to what I've called modern and postmodern constraints. So C++ 17, as I said, gave us constexpr_if. And along with it, we got what are called discarded statements. Remember my theme. If the constraint doesn't hold, it's not compiled. Here, they explicitly become discarded statements. Be a little bit careful if you haven't used this before. There is a requirement that even discarded statements have to be well-formed. That's a little stronger than is actually true, but that's a good guideline to start with. Okay? So for example, don't put a static assert in a constexpr_if. Here's a trivia question for you. Do you know what part of speech is a static assert? It's a declaration. It's considered a declaration if you look at the standard. There's your C++ trivia for the day. Okay? So, you know, every branch of a constexpr_if has to be at least parsable. Okay? So it differs from like pound if in this regard. If it's not there, you know, we don't really care. So using a constexpr_if, we get what I think is the most readable version of my algorithm so far. It's one function, as it should be. I don't have to mess with overloading. And my constraints are embedded in the constexpr_if. Right? If constexpr n is a 0, return this. And the other becomes a discarded statement. It's not there when n is 0. And if n is not 0, this branch is a discarded statement. It's not present. okay? Else if it's even, do this. Else it must be odd, do that. So I like this a lot, and I hope you consider it, as I do, a great improvement on our coding style and technique. But it still doesn't fit all situations. It fits a lot, but it's still not a universal solution. Which brings us to concepts. Only because we published something called the Concepts Technical Specification, TS. This is a feature that started out life being called Concepts Light. Somewhere along the way, we dropped the light part of it. So maybe this is now Concepts Heavy, I'm not sure. But it's the Concepts Technical Specification, and that's what formally has introduced the requires keyword and brought us what is called the requires clause. That was the first specification. And I'll tell you how that's been progressing in the standards committee. It wasn't quite ready for C++ 17. Part of it was. The part I want to talk about, I thought was ready for C++ 17. And I proposed that we split it and take what was ready and, you know, leave the rest for later. I got shouted down. There were some people who just took a scorched earth approach. It's all or nothing. Well, they got nothing. But that's, I consider that very unfortunate. Nonetheless, as it happens, a requires clause can be applied to any kind of template, variable template, alias template, class template, of course, function template, okay, any kind of template, but also to an ordinary garden variety function. The status with lambdas is a little unclear at this point, but I am hopeful that we'll get it in that context as well. Okay? If you apply it in the case of an ordinary function, we have special nomenclature. We call it a trailing requires clause because it follows the typical declaration of the function. Okay? Like a trailing return type, it actually follows that. Okay? So here are a couple of technical details about requires. A requires clause induces constraints. Now, in a technical sense, I've been slightly abusing the term constraints. We now are going to get a technical definition of constraint. Now, let me start by drawing an analogy for you, okay? A lot of C++ programmers informally speak of, they say they have a lambda, and at some point they call the lambda. Well, that's technically wrong. You can't call a lambda. When you evaluate, when you run the lambda's evaluated, you get a kind of function object. That's what you get when you evaluate a lambda. And that function object has an operands operator. That's what gets called. That function object is known as There's a special term for this.
Closure.
When you evaluate a lambda, you get a closure. It's not a function. A closure is a special kind of function object. Why do you need that? Because you have to do the captures. You need a place to put the stuff you've captured that goes into the function object, into the closure. Okay? So it becomes closed. Okay? That's why it's called a closure. So what has it got to do here? Well, technically, when you write a requires clause, you're not writing constraints. You write a predicate, and the compiler will turn that into the appropriate constraints. So we say the constraints are induced by the requires clause. Okay? So slight shift in nomenclature. I'm going to stick with the informal. I'm going to call it a constraint, but please be aware, technically, the constraint is what the compiler turns this into. Okay? And of course, if the constraint is not satisfied, this component to which you've attached the requires clause will not be instantiated or compiled in any way. Just, it won't exist. Okay? That component simply is ignored, much like Svine. The machinery is slightly different, but the outcome is very similar. Okay? It won't exist. That's the theme of this talk. The constraint isn't satisfied, the component won't exist. And that can be a good thing, as we've already seen. Okay? You just have to be careful in your code. Don't use a non-existent component. That's an error. Well, that makes sense. It's always been an error. Call a function f, you don't have a function f, that's an error. Same idea. What comes along with this is a new consideration known as subsumption, because constraints can be related to each other. One constraint can subsume another. It's like a subset relationship. And this is a way of comparing constraints, because one constraint can be more constraining than another. Think about my example. I have a constraint, n is even. I have another constraint, n is 0. Well, in that case, n is also even. But this is more constrained. Okay? And this can be important. The compiler can now tell which is, you know, comparing two constraints, which is the more constrained. And this is one of the reasons why technically you don't write the constraints, the compiler does. It puts it into a form so it can do this kind of analysis. Okay? Okay. Notice, please, nothing I have said relies on concepts per se. Yet this is all machinery that's necessary for concepts. It doesn't require that we use concepts at all. I have been programming almost exclusively with requires clauses for over 3, maybe 4 years now. They're wonderful. I love them. I have not written a concept in 3.5 years that I can recall. It's the kind of programming that I do doesn't require concepts. Now, concepts are better in a certain sense, and that gets into philosophical issues of what makes a good concept. And as far as I know, nobody has yet really addressed that to any detail. We have some ideas of what makes a good concept. Nobody has ever set forth a set of guidelines yet. A good concept should satisfy criteria A, B, C. I'm waiting for that. But I'm probably not going to be the one to do that. But programming with constraints, it's wonderful. Here's an example. Suppose I have 3 different transmit functions. And of course, transmission relies heavily on endianness, right? I mean, there are other ways of coding this, but imagine for a second. But I think you'll agree, this is an unusual overload set. How come? Because they all have the same signature. You're not supposed to do this. Well, now you can, with the requires clause. How can that work? The answer is almost too simple. The requires clause becomes part of the signature. So now you can tell them apart again, right? And what happens when you have one that has no requires clause and another one? We've got answers for all of those interesting questions, okay? So as you can imagine by now, only declarations whose constraint is satisfied, constraint in the informal sense, go into the overload set of viable candidates, and then overload resolution takes over and so on and so forth, okay? And if the constraint isn't satisfied, it doesn't exist, so it's not an issue, okay? Now, since most of us, I think, are new to requires clauses, let me tell you a little bit about what they look like. You can put any predicate you want after the keyword requires. Any predicate you want. And in my case, a particularly useful kind of predicate is a type trait. Right? I want this function only to be operative, or this template to be operative, only if you hand me an integer type, or a floating point type, or a this or a that. Or it has to be copyable, or it has to be movable, etc. Okay, and those are type traits. So I personally find those useful, but I've used constraints of many different kinds. The point is, Any predicate works. Now, if you happen to lump a bunch of requirements together and give that collection a name, you have a concept. So if you've done that, then you can refer to that collection by name. You don't have to repeat all the pieces of that collection. It's a form of factoring, right? So if you have a concept and it happens to be named C, just to keep it short for a moment, then you can say requires C brackets T. And it looks like a template instantiation. And in some sense it is. It isn't quite, but it's similar, okay? You can just say requires C of T. Or there are some shorter forms that are possible. Alexander Stepanov, for 20 years now, has been lobbying for us to be able to write template C of T, which is absolutely equivalent to the longer form class T dot 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 requires C of T. Okay, that's what I mean by a shorter form. There might be others as well. That's a little bit up in the air right now. But this is a syntax that we've been using for some time, and this is one of particular interest to Alexander Stepanov. If you go online and watch his videos on YouTube, which I highly recommend, first of all, set aside a week or two of your time, because not only are there a lot of them, they are deep, and you will want to think hard about what you're hearing, okay? I mean, the man was a first-class, I mean, he's now retired, that's why I say was, first-class mathematician. One of the few people I know who've read Euclid in the original Greek. One of the few people I know who've read Euclid. So what I'd like to do now is to walk you through a case study that happened to me late last year, and I wrote it up early this year. Okay? Like so many things, I stepped in this. Okay? Since I've been retired, I get to play. I get to work on what I want to work on. And I've always been interested in the Standard Library. And I never had the chance to do much with the Standard Library of my own. So I now have a private implementation of what I call the interesting part of the Standard Library. And I'm not going to do it all, ever. I'm not interested in all of it. But I'm interested mostly in utility components. Because I've been a library writer for most of my professional career. So I write things for other programmers to use. And there's a certain knack to that, okay? So in particular, I mean, how much more basic can you get than std swap, right? I mean, we should be using std swap a lot more than we do. A lot of times you should not use assignment, you should use std swap. If you do things with concurrent programming, do the work, and when you're ready, get the lock, swap your result into place, and release the lock. So std swap is an incredibly important component. It has given WG21, the standards committee, headaches ever since we brought it into the standard. Because there are types that want to customize how they swap. Right? Imagine how you swap a vector. You don't change everything from one vector to the other. You take the pointer from here and the pointer from there and you swap the pointers. You're done. It's very fast. So we want to be able to customize swap. So it's what we call a customization point. But, you know, that's another talk. But what I did is I've implemented swap for our purposes twice. I've done it many more times. But imagine that I did it twice. Once I used, let's say, the now classical enable if technology, and the second time I used only this requires technology. Okay? And it turned out the bodies of the function, which is not very interesting. It's a traditional three-step swap, right? You know how I used to teach swap to freshmen? You got a little kid who likes to drink chocolate milk. You got another little kid who likes to drink white milk. They all have their own cups. You accidentally put them in the wrong cups. How do you swap the milk? You get a third cup. Right? Three-step swap. Every freshman understands that. I don't know. Maybe freshmen like chocolate milk. I'm not sure. But std swap is absolutely fundamental. So I did this a couple of times. The function bodies were the same, but the function introductions obviously were different, because one had the enable if, the other one had requires. And there was no overlap. Okay? And then, of course, I wanted to be sure that I did it right, that it passes tests. And instead of writing my own tests, I used publicly and also privately available test suites. For example, Clang has a test suite, GCC has a public test suite. No, and I run my stuff through those test suites, and I sometimes write my own. And I have access to some private test suites as well. And I was completely surprised, because I ended up with a subtle, totally unexpected difference in the behavior. Shockingly surprised. Let me walk you through it, if I may. So let me just refresh our memories. This is what the standard says about swap. This is what the declaration has to look like. Okay, I've elided the stuff in the no except clause that's not really relevant to this discussion. It's messy. Okay? And then, and I'm quoting directly, look at the highlighted yellow words, please. We call things like that words of power. They have a special significance in the standard. Okay? It's a formula. You'll find it over and over and over again if you read the standard. And it specifies a special kind of constraint. It tells the implementer something he has to do. These words mean we need svine, used to mean svine, now I say svine-like behavior. Namely, this swap must not be instantiated if the type is not movable. Now, please recall, movable implies copyable. You don't have to have move functionality. If you have copy functionality, it's considered movable. It's also considered movable if you have move operations. If they're available, we'll use them. If they're not available, we'll fall back to copy. So that's all subsumed by calling it movable. Okay? But we must not instantiate this if we don't have movability. Okay? And if you try to call it and your type doesn't have movability, you can't do a swap using std swap. That makes sense. Okay? So here's what I did. And I'm only going to show you the declarations because the bodies are not really very interesting for our purposes. So here's what the enable if looks like. Right? Enable if, and the predicate is movable. And if it is movable, the return type is void. And if it's not movable, there's no return type, it's ill-formed, etc. Won't be compiled. Okay? So that's what I call the classical way of satisfying the constraint, right? And just to spell it out in detail, the enable if is the return type. There are two possibilities. If it holds, this is basically what I told them. You get void, it's well-formed, everything's fine. The predicate doesn't hold, there's no return type, ill-formed, svine, gone. Everybody with me? Yeah? Okay, good. Then I did it again. And the second one, I mean, this should be pretty straightforward. There's a requires clause. Right? I mean, this is a template. Notice where it goes. It's a requirement on the template parameters. So it goes after the template and before the function declaration. Right? Requires is movable. And there's an ordinary return type now, right? It's the requires clause that induces the constraint. I'm meeting the same constraint, is movable. And again, there are two possibilities. If the constraint is satisfied, the declaration is well formed, it becomes viable, all is fine. If the constraint is not satisfied, the declaration is non-viable and it's discarded in a svine-like way. It's not exactly svine, but you get the same net effect. Cool. And then came validation. As I said, I ran through some test suites. Swap worked like a champ. But the test suite also had a test for a trait in the standard library named isSwappable. I hand you a type, and you tell me yes or no, you can call swap on your type. Not necessarily std swap. There is a swap that will work with your type. That's what isSwappable is for. Enable if worked like a champ. Requires clause, failed. How did it fail? It's kind of, now, here are the details, right? I'm condensed. I had to change some of the names to shorten them so that they fit. So the test has its own namespace, NS in this case. It introduces just a trivial type named A. And then in the same namespace, a swap. Now, right now, there's no overload here because they're in different namespaces. So what happens when you put them into the same namespace? And you can do that with a using declaration. You can do that with I mean, there are several ways to do that, okay? So consider these three statements in a row. Let's declare a pair of variables of this new type, A and B. Let's bring the standard swap into scope with the using, and now let's call swap unqualified, okay? And this reads like a final exam for like second term freshmen or something, right? So what's going to happen? Now, this is not a quiz. I'm not here to tease you or anything like that. It goes like this. You get two lookups. You get ordinary or unqualified lookup, and of course, it's going to find std swap because that's in scope directly. It's the only swap that's in scope. And then ADL kicks in, and it's going to find the swap in the associated namespace because the variables come from namespace NS, and there's a swap in there. So we go look in there and we find it. Now I have an overload set. So now we have to do overload resolution. And part of overload resolution, which finds both to be viable. So which one's better? And the part of overload resolution that answers this question is called partial ordering. Because you want to put an order to these. Which one is better? Right? And the answer is neither. It's ambiguous, right? Can't make the call. It's ambiguous. And the actual line that tested this was a static assert. And notice the negation in the predicate. The test passes if the type A, cap A, is not swappable, right? Because of ambiguity, right? Test passes if it's not swappable. And it turns out that works fine for the enable if, and it fails for the requires. So what's different? Requires clauses bring new rules, or a new rule. Okay? It's a new tiebreaker. It's along the lines of what we have today. More specialized, more constrained. Okay? If you have two requires, two candidates, they're both viable. Look at the constraints. Which one is more constrained? That's the winner. Subsumption, remember? If one subsumes the other, it's more constrained. That's your winner. Okay? So in my second implementation, std swap was constrained with the requires clause, therefore this rule kicks in. Even though the private one in the namespace was not constrained, the rule still kicks in. If you think about it, an unconstrained template is like saying requires true. It's always satisfied. Okay? So the new rule applies. The test code is no longer ambiguous. But the test expects ambiguity, and therefore the test now fails. I stepped in it. This was not expected, okay? Now, quick caveat, what I'm presenting, of course, is not yet in the standard. Look at the next standard that we're still working on, right? But this works today, has worked for many years with GCC-F concepts, okay? Recent developments, we've taken much of the wording, not all, but we've taken a lot of the wording out of the TS, out of the concepts TS, it's in the working draft. It's already been tweaked quite a bit. It's probably going to be tweaked some more because discussions are ongoing. We've got a few years before C++ 20. So what I'm telling you today might still be true. or it might be slightly or not so slightly different. I can't predict the future. I don't have that kind of crystal ball. But the principles, I think, will hold up. Namely, C++ core language constraints, when we get them, are more than just a language replacement for enable if. Right? Some people would say much more. If one is present, the constraint comes into play whenever you instantiate a template, whenever you use the name of a template. It comes in during overload resolution, as we've seen, especially during partial ordering, as we've seen. Here's an example of what you can't do. So here's a trivial function where the constraint is never satisfied, right? Requires false. So that just doesn't exist. So of course you can't call it, you can't take its address, you can't even say decal type of that type. It doesn't exist, it doesn't have a type. Okay? You must not use a component if it doesn't exist. Okay? And I'm quite confident that that will always hold true. Okay? Constraints become an integral part of a declaration. Traditional declarations that aren't constrained this way, namely with a requires clause, aren't quite the same. You get an extra set of rules for overload resolution, for example. We have to be aware of those rules. And it's become clear to me that many of these details, maybe most of them, excuse me, are not yet very widely well understood. And even among experts, there was a recent posting, and I'm withholding the name of who did it, an expert, someone I consider an expert in C++. His advice is almost right. Okay? You have to do something out of the ordinary to see the difference. But it is, as we've seen, detectable. As I said, I stepped in it. Okay? So Andrew Sutton, who is actually the editor of the concepts technical specification, he's here at this conference. I think he's speaking later this week. He wrote me at one point, and he said this, among other things, that if you add constraints to an existing overload set that's unconstrained, it potentially changes the result. So you need to think about that very, very hard. Okay? You can't just replace enable if with requires without thinking about it, because there is a tiny detectable semantic difference. It may make no difference. It usually will make no difference. But it potentially can make a difference. Vendors of the standard library are free to do this today. There's no rule that says they have to wait for C++ 20 to make use of this technology. It's in compilers already. And boy, can it make life easier for standard library and other library implementers. It's a wonderful, wonderful tool, and I recommend it highly. As I say, I've been using it for years, near exclusively. But as I said, it's detectable, and it has the potential to affect code in certain edge cases. Okay? You may have to go on a scavenger hunt to find those cases, but they exist, as I've shown. And with that, thank you very much. Do we have a couple minutes? We have a minute or two for questions. If you have a question, please come to a microphone. Anybody? Ah, looks like we got two. All right. I'll do my best, sir.
Okay. So thanks for the talk, first of all.
My pleasure.
You mentioned that in order to be able to tell the different overloads with the requires clause apart,
yes,
the requires actually becomes part of the signature.
Yes.
Does that also imply that during name mangling, the expression in the requires gets mangled into the name of the function?
The standard does not mandate anything about mangling. That does sound to me like a viable implementation technique, if potentially awkward, but I'm not the right person to address that.
Okay.
Okay. If this becomes standard, the compiler writer has to make it work.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we just say how it has to behave. You figure out how to get it done.
Sir, I had a question about the example you showed in the circumstance whereby one would add a requirements clause to a function that had no template arguments.
Yeah.
If and then you you had a clause there which had a variable whose something that was called local, and it was totally unclear where that would come from.
Yeah. And I should have addressed that at the time. Forgive me for interrupting you. Assume for the moment that there is some kind of global by that name.
Okay.
Okay. And that there is an those were.
All right.
I should have mentioned that the working paper actually has byte ordering primitives in it now. I don't know if they'll stay in the present form, but I try to use the names that we have for the moment.
So the functions that would be selected might be determined by some global variables of constant variables, which are constant values, which are determined at compile time.
Correct.
Does that sound like a great idea?
Depends how you use it.
Okay.
I mean, does a saw sound like a great idea? I wouldn't give it to a 5-year-old. Okay. One tip. I'm hopeful that you will all go and share this knowledge with your colleagues. I'd like to offer a suggestion, if I may. Think about your audience. For people like us who've been in the business a while, I've presented this material in a direction I call bottom up. For people who are novices or apprentices, think about presenting this top down. They don't need to know all the ins and outs. They just need to know what the behaviors are and how to use it and when to use it. They don't need to know that this is constraint programming. And I've got some hidden slides, by the way, so if you go and download what I'm going to upload, you'll find a couple extra slides that I hid because I was going to run out of time. One final question. I'm sorry. I'm going to run out. If you want, I'll be happy to talk to you in the hallway. Thank you.
Do you anticipate that requires will completely subsume Sphinae, or there are some set of problems you will still use Sphinae for?
I think there is still a role for Sphinae. I believe it's going to diminish, but we have large code bases that aren't going to go away anytime soon. So we'll be dealing with Sphinae for a very long time to come.
But moving forward, like?
New code, starting in C++ 20. I would assume that once the word gets out, that required clauses will take over from Sphinae.
Okay,
it just somehow seems more intuitive. I hope you'll agree with me. Anyway, thank you all very much. I appreciate you being here. Thank you.